Here's the variety we can expect this week. Rain, periods of rain, chance of showers, showers. Cloudy is the high point, but then back to periods of rain. When I came up this morning, Peter, it was actually pretty nice out.
It was, yes. It was.
You know, sunny, and it looked like it was going to be clear skies, but the forecast calls for increasing cloudiness with rain beginning this afternoon. Fog patches, I saw that coming up up the hill here today. The fog down in the valley over Burnaby Lake looked really pretty in the sunshine, but it's going to turn to rain. And a high 9 degrees, cooler overnight, but pretty much 9, 10, 11 degrees all week long. I guess that's typical for this time of year.
Well, actually for this area, you talk about the area of the world we're in, this is a hard place to actually say what the weather's going to be, actually.
Oh, I know that. You know, like here in Vancouver, you know, it's like if you don't like the weather, just hang around for half an hour and you'll probably be different.
Well, in general, I think there's some other areas of the world you can more figure out what the weather's going to be, but this is a rainforest area, so you can't quite figure out what's going to happen.
All right. Next up, we have a recording of Arthur Conan Doyle. He is, of course, the creator of the very famous Sherlock Holmes series, and one of the sort of creators and chief popularizers of the mystery novel in the late 19th century. This is a recording, part of a series called The Spoken Word, British Writers, and here's the introduction to the little bit we're going to hear. This is, in fact, the voice of Arthur Conan Doyle speaking about Sherlock Holmes. The creator of Sherlock Holmes left two audio-visual clues as to his character. An 11-minute film made in 1929, originally part of the movie Tone sound reel, and this sound recording dating from 2 months before his death. In each, Arthur Conan Doyle described in very similar terms the two subjects that were dearest to him, and how he came to create Sherlock Holmes, and his belief in spiritualism. In July 1930, a week after his death, thousands of people attended a séance in the Royal Albert Hall, at which a medium claimed to have made contact with him, an event later made a key episode in Julian Barnes' movie Arthur and George. This is a recording that's about 8 minutes long from 1930, just a few months before his death, Arthur Conan Doyle.
There are two questions which my friends continually ask me. One is how I came to write Sherlock Holmes, and the other is why I became a spiritualist and about spiritualism generally. With regard to Sherlock Holmes, I was, when I wrote it, a young doctor and had been educated in a very severe and critical medical school of thought, especially coming under the influence of Dr. Bell of Edinburgh, who had most remarkable powers of observation. He prided himself that when he looked at a patient, he could tell not only their disease, but very often their occupation and place of residence. Reading some detective stories, I was struck by the fact that their results were obtained in nearly every case by chance. I accept, of course, Edgar Allan Poe's splendid stories, which, though only three in number, are a model for all time. I thought I would try my hand at writing a story where the hero would treat crime as Dr. Bell treated disease, and where science would take the place of chance. The result was Sherlock Holmes, and I confess that result has surprised me very much, for I learn that many schools of detection, working in France, in Egypt, in China, and elsewhere, have admittedly founded their system upon that of Holmes. To many, he seems to be a real person, and I have had numerous letters from time to time addressed to him from all parts of the world, and the most quaint requests, including what was virtually an offer of marriage. His autograph also is much in demand. Now as to the more serious subject. The result of my medical education in the days of Huxley and Haeckel was to make me agnostic in matters of religion. And certainly I had no belief that we survived death. I've always, of course, kept my mind open to new ideas, for the day a man's mind shuts is the day of his mental death. In 1887, some curious psychic experiences came my way. And especially, I was impressed by the fact of telepathy, which I proved for myself by experiments with a friend. The question then arose, if two incarnate minds could communicate, is it possible for a discarnate one to communicate with one that is still in the body? For more than 20 years, I examined the evidence and came finally to the conclusion beyond all doubt that such communication was possible. I could give hundreds of illustrations to prove my point, but I can only refer you to the literature of the subject. I took my proofs from actual personal experiments, as well as from the work of such great men as Sir William Crookes, Myers, Dr. Russell Wallace, and others. The full importance of the matter did not come home to me until the war, when all the world was asking, where are our dead boys? And getting such unsatisfactory answers, both from the churches and from science. Then it was that my wife and I felt that our knowledge on the subject was of enormous importance, and that we could answer this universal question. 12 years of our lives have now been spent in trying to impart our knowledge to others, in the course of which we have traveled 75,000 miles, and we have addressed 250,000 of people. The work has now been too much for me. It has weakened my heart, and I am temporarily disabled. But perhaps by this record, I could say a word to a new and worldwide audience. That word is that there is nothing in this new knowledge to destroy the foundations of your present belief. But, on the contrary, that it adds a knowledge and a feeling of security such as no other system of philosophy has been able to give. The basis of all religions is that we live after death, and the proving of the truth of this basis is, to my mind, the most essential work in this age of perplexity and materialism, when good and earnest men honestly doubt whether death is not the end. People ask, what do you get from spiritualism? The first thing you get is that it absolutely removes all fear of death. Secondly, it bridges death for those dear ones whom we may lose. We need have no fear that we are calling them back, for all that we do is to make such conditions as experience has taught us will enable them to come if they wish, and the initiative lies always with them. They have many times told us that they could not come back if it were not God's will, and that it makes them intensely happy to be able to help and to comfort us, to tell us about their happy life in that world to which we are, in our turn, destined to come. People say that only trivialities come through. In effecting recognition, this has some truth. If, for example, some dear one returned to me, he could not prove his identity to me by discussing high matters. But he could do so by reminding me of past private experiences known only to himself and to me. But in contact with higher spirit people, we do get lofty religious teaching and most inspiring knowledge. The press, unfortunately, usually only notices spiritualism when fraud or folly is in question. Fraud and folly do exist, as in everything. But the press does not mention, as a rule, The thousands of cases where consolation and proof have been brought to suffering hearts. We bring important facts, new facts, which will revolutionize the whole thought of the human race, both in religion and in science. It is the great question of the future, and it will end by making religion a real living thing, so that all doubt of God's goodness or of the destiny of mankind will be forever banished, since we shall each be in actual touch with what is higher than ourselves, and the communion of saints will at last be an established fact.
There we go. Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, speaking from a recording in 1930, just months before his death. He was born in 1859 and lived until 1930, and of course, one of the most famous writers in the English language, and creator of one of novel's most famous characters, Sherlock Holmes. We'll be back in a few minutes with Peter talking about George Soros. But first off, this is Bird Note, and they're talking about the Andean Cock of the Walk.
This is Bird Note. The cloud forests of the Andes Mountains offer a symphony of bird sounds. But there's also something less melodic. Something that sounds like a cross between a chainsaw and a squealing pig. In fact, it's another bird, the Andean Cock of the Rock. The national bird of Peru, male birds of this species sport a splendid bright red plumage along with a head crest reminiscent of a knight's battle helmet. Their headgear is often so big, it looks like it might throw them off balance in flight. True to form with their bold plumage, the Andean Cock of the Rock also takes part in, well, cocky mating rituals. During mating season, groups of males gather at centrally located leks, or breeding spots, where they scream, grunt, flap their wings, bob their heads, and clack their bills at each other in mock fights. Once the more modest brown-feathered females arrive to the party, they make their choice amongst the dancing males. Then they head off to build a nest high in a cliff wall. As for the mate, she leaves him back in the lek to keep bickering with the other jealous suitors. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
We're back. You're listening to Speak Up here on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Magnus, and Peter's here with me. You're going to...
George Soros. One thing... as I said a bit earlier, I said my concern was the third world currency trading he was doing, not what he's funding now.
Why don't you just set him up? Who is George Soros, and why has he come to such prominence?
Well, actually, when he gave up, one thing I found out was that it was around 1988, he said, he had the quantum fund, but they were not speculating in third world currency.
Right,
he was really up to that. He Japanese yen.
Like a hedge fund. He was a hedge fund manager, and I guess currency trader. Go ahead.
It was a variety of things. And then suppose he said 1988 he was going to take it easy. He was going to think what I can give back. Now, what was interesting, I found out, I didn't realize this, that somebody took over the overall operating of the Quantum Fund in 1988. That's Stanley Druckenmiller. So I wasn't aware of that until I looked over what was the history of his investing. Now, when he began doing the giving away money for these things, it was really the quantum fun was really being directed by this other person, and he of course had a bit of he was making money off of it, but he was not the person who was directing it. I wasn't aware of that. But what's interesting, he was on Charlie Rose, 1992. And Charlie Rose, the PBS program, mm-hmm. started in 1991. So he was sort of in there quite quick. And I saw one of the interviews or two of them and explaining what he was doing and so on. But it's interesting that it's really under the other person that we got the currency trading. And also, Nelson Mandela contacted George Soros in 1998, and he said, "How can our country protect ourselves against the speculation?" And George Soros didn't really have an answer for him. He said, "Well, you got to do your best," and he didn't have an answer for him. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that was a bit odd, one of the first things that he was doing when it was apartheid, very early on, he was giving out his money, was that it was a scholarship funds. This was how he was helping out blacks in apartheid South Africa, what they were doing, the apartheid government was just absorbing it into what they were already giving to black students anyway. But I find it very ineffectual, his things in general, what he's doing. Now, there's one economist, Paul Krugman, is one person who has been critical of the effect of the investing. And what it comes down to is that it's more than George Soros's wealth, because he doesn't have all the funds in the quantum fund. And this became a way for other investors to follow his lead. And Paul Krugman actually thought he was causing havoc in the currency speculation. Now, what's sort of funny about Paul Krugman, I've seen over the years, he's on panels with George Soros, and he doesn't say anything about it. But he has spoken up against him as such. But he doesn't – sometimes they'll beside each other on a panel, and he won't even speak up about it. So it's a rather – he kind of – when he went to the London School of Economics, there was this pauper person. He gets this rather esoteric concepts about open society, and I kind of find it very esoteric what he's exactly doing. Now, the other thing this is a key point mm-hmm. I found out about him. Is that he actually funds a lot of organizations, but I found out that they're only like up to 5 or 10% is the most he will give any organization, really. So
you mean like 5 to 10% of their overall revenue?
Yes, yeah, of their operating budget is
right.
And so I think it was Glenn Beck said there was all these organizations that he was funding, but the thing was he was only funding part of it, that all these organizations really could have existed without his funds, which is sort of a bit odd.
And he's become a real sort of bugaboo or villain to many pundits on the right when they want to talk about some sort of liberal villain who's sowing, I don't know what they're worried about, in the world. They often will, name George Soros as this person for folks on the right.
Well, he also baits them. Now, the other thing about it is that in 2004, he gave quite a bit to the campaign to get Kerry elected president instead of mm-hmm. George W. Bush again.
Right.
And he has at times funded directly or like indirectly things, and I think it's sort of unfair because they'll say, "Well, it's this anti-Jewish trope they keep saying on CNN or on the NFBC. It's sort of kind of shallow because they make any criticism of that anti-Semitic, which I think is a bit unfair, actually. And he sort of abates the he's baiting people, because one thing is that what happened was he's a bit clever in this. He made it seem worse than it was. During World War II, as being a Jewish person, he didn't really get people going to concentration camps, which he kind of alludes that he's doing that. But what he did was him and his father took their property, or they basically, it was going to happen anyway, so they made a list for them, and they said they weren't Jewish, and they sort of done this. But then he says things like, oh, they were the happiest days of my life, and it sort of, because he said, well, it was kind of unfortunate. But he actually cleverly makes it worse than what it was. And then it's like, then he says, people are against me. I couldn't help it. So he kind of plays people, I think, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is how I feel about it. I wanted to see a Time cover article from 1997 on George Soros. Then I found out because here we have, in Canada, we have our own edition of Time. And they didn't have it. I went to the library, tried to find it, and then it wound up they had was about some other topic. Asthma, actually. It wasn't about George Soros. So I wasn't able to find that. But there was, I found online, a mm-hmm. Jewish Journal is a magazine, July 14th to 20th of this year, and they had an article on him. And actually, amongst the Jewish people, there's not a complete... the lawyer Alwin Dershowitz doesn't like that he turned against Israel, supposedly. So it's not really a real amongst the Jewish organizations or whatever. It's not uses it against people from the right who criticize him, but there's sort of many views on him in the Jewish population. Mm-hmm. Actually.
Now, is he Jewish himself?
Yes, he is Jewish.
Okay. I was just looking him up and didn't really mention that. Mentions him as Hungarian. American, which doesn't preclude him from being Jewish. I was just
He's still alive.
All right.
And the other thing is that it's sometimes said that he doesn't have as much wealth as like Elon Musk has $253 billion, Bill Gates $118 billion, and he's got something like what is this, $32 billion. And then people say, oh, they're making too much out of him. But as I said, I think it was he was influencing other investors,
mm-hmm.
and I think maybe this is sort of a past thing, but he was not allowing third world countries to have a stable currency, in my opinion.
Well, it's definitely a lot of the hedge funds and other sort of financial operators like that. They can make a lot of money out of what they call shorting something.
Yes, I don't quite understand that. Sometimes you're going against, you're saying you want it to be a bad result and you can win off that.
They do it by, one of the ways you do something like that is you borrow whatever the commodity that you're going to short, right? You borrow it, you don't buy it, and you borrow it basically on a loan. You say, hey, buddy, here's your, whatever this commodity is, I'm going to borrow that, and then they short it, so they make it fall in price, and then they sell it on the market. Basically what they did, they borrow it, and then they sell it, right?
Right.
At the high price, and then they do some manipulations to cause the price to fall, and they buy it back at a lower price, and then they give it back to the person they borrowed it from. And they get to keep that difference between the high price they sold it at and the low price they bought it for. even though they never really owned it in the first place. I mean, it's risky because, of course, if you sell it at this price and it goes the other way, you got to give it back at a higher price.
Well, and what he was famous for was in 1992, the British pound took a hit.
Yeah, and he shorted that by, I heard, made like $1 billion in a very short period of time by
which was
forcing
under?
The, you know, I guess shorting the pound and forcing it to sell, fall in price, and then profiting from that loss.
Which was under the other person, actually, Stanley Druckenmiller, was actually the one in charge of the overall thing of the quantum fund, actually.
Right.
So that's, anyway.
So, yeah, it's definitely a way of creating lots of chaos in markets, or problems. You know, lots of people get hurt when all that value is lost, even though they're making money from it. All right, thank you for bringing us George Soros today.
Okay.
International villain to the right and philanthropist and billionaire to others.
Well, maybe. Neither, maybe.
That too, and probably more likely the truth. Speaking of billionaires, did you hear about Mark Zuckerberg's enormous compound and bunker that he's been building in Hawaii?
No, I haven't.
It's in an article by Wired and picked up by a bunch of other news services. I read about it yesterday. But apparently on the island of Kauai, he's building an enormous walled compound that's entirely self-sufficient and includes like 20 buildings, including three huge mansions, 30 bedrooms, so he can have all his friends over. But it also includes a 5,000-square-foot underground bunker and a series of tunnels that allows people who are there to travel between the different buildings and the bunker without even having to go above ground.
Well, I don't know why he's doing that.
Some people suspect that he's preparing for some sort of collapse, and he's thinking he can insulate himself by using his money and resources to create like a fortified place to retreat.
Well, do you know if he lost some money like a few years ago or something?
Well, I'd have to go back and look at it, but I do believe that Meta, the company, sort of took a hit and lost a bunch of value. I mean, you know, it's like going from having, you know, 10 times as much money as you'd ever need to live comfortably to having 5 times as much money as you ever need to live comfortably.
Yeah,
so it's not really a big loss for him. But, you know, it is a loss in, I guess, power.
Yeah, it's like Bill Gates is sort of a power player. He's sort of, you don't hear about him much anymore. Because he wasn't involved.
Well, you heard him a lot. COVID because he was quite active in certain areas of research.
Oh, I didn't
with know. His philanthropy. Bill Gates, that is.
I know that Bill Gates, but we're talking about Zuckerberg.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I guess he's laying a little lower than he used to be. We're almost out of time here. Thank you for bringing us that segment today, Peter. We'll be back in the new year next week and the following week. We will have some highlight programs featuring some of the more interesting interviews. And we should have a new community organization feature from Kay. So that'll be to look forward to. And on January 1st, we have an interview from that I did last week from the Crab Park Camp. And we're going to get the inside view on homeless camp living and the fights they're putting up to improve their conditions and the situation for homeless throughout our region. So it's coming up on January 1st. Tomorrow is part two of our witnessing discussion, featuring a discussion about the work of Tima Igar. We aired part one last week. That's our show for today. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for Kay for her interview. Thanks to Peter for your segment. Democracy Now! Is coming up in just a few moments. But until then, here's a little bit of Leila Bialy.